This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Prisoners held by the United States in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, have the right to appeal their detention in U.S. federal court. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled today the government is violating the rights of 270 men held at Guantanamo, and further, that those prisoners can appeal their classification as enemy combatants. Writing for the majority, Justice Anthony Kennedy said, "The laws and Constitution are designed to survive and remain in force in extraordinary times." In dissent, Chief Justice John Roberts criticized the majority for striking down what he described as the most generous set of procedural protections ever afforded aliens detained by this country as enemy combatants. And Justice Antonin Scalia wrote that we are at war with radical Islamists and that the court's decision today will make that war harder on us. It will, he added, almost certainly cause more Americans to be killed. The decision is a major blow to the Bush administration, but its practical effects are still unclear. If you'd like to know more about the reasoning on both sides and what the ruling means, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Send us email, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, a new documentary on steroids in America, bigger, stronger, faster. But first, David Savage, Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times, joins us here in Studio 3A. And David, it's always good to see you here.
Hi, Neil.
And this is the third time this issue has come before the court and the third time that the administration's arguments have been rejected.
Yes, that's right. We've been sort of through this before. The real bottom line question here, Neil, was who was going to decide in the end whether these people could be detained indefinitely? Would it be the military, which is what the Bush administration said, or judges? And in a 5-4, the court said judges, that since the beginning of the Constitution, the notion has been that if the government is going to lock you up and hold you, that you have a right to go before a judge and argue that you've got the wrong man, I'm not who you say you are, and I should be freed. And basically, that's what the court said, that in the end, this is a matter for judges to decide.
What you just described is pretty much the writ of habeas corpus. Produce the body, and goes back not just throughout the U.S. Constitution, but in English common law.
Yes, that's absolutely right, and the court detailed a lot of that history. As you know, the difficulty, of course, is whether habeas corpus applies in a military setting, because there's a whole lot of law on the other side that says, well, if you're a war prisoner, as Justice Scalia said, we didn't give the several hundred thousand Germans held in the United States hearings because that was a war situation. So we've been in court fighting about 6 years over sort of what's the right way to understand the detainees in this current, whatever it is, war on terror. And as I say, the court has been closely split all along, but they keep coming out. There's basically been a 5-4 majority to say this is a matter for judges to decide in the end. And so they're saying these people can go to court and can argue for their freedom.
They also said the last time this was rejected, the Bush administration went to Congress and had Congress pass a law setting out these new procedures and all of these things. Effectively, what the court's decision today was to overturn that law?
Yes, that's exactly right. 4 years ago, the court said the habeas law on the books gives these people a right to go to court. The administration went back to Congress, they changed the law, and then now, 2 years after they changed the law, the Supreme Court said, no, it's unconstitutional to take away the right to habeas corpus except during times of grave national emergency when the writ can be suspended. This is not that, and therefore the law is unconstitutional.
And of course it was suspended during the Civil War, famously,
yes,
by
that's
Abraham
correct.
Lincoln. Yes,
that was an insurrection.
They also said about this proceeding under which these prisoners were classified as enemy combatants, they said that proceeding was inadequate. The government has to do it again?
Well, the government set up sort of a midpoint procedure where they said some military officers would review your case and decide whether you're an enemy combatant. And the court basically said that procedure is flawed in a number of different ways. You don't have a real lawyer. You can't demand to see all the evidence against you. You can't bring in new evidence. And the court said that's basically flawed. That doesn't substitute for the right to go before a judge. And so, as I say, this is a sort of, you can go before a judge. I should say, though, the court did not, in the end, say what the law is. I mean, suppose I can think of two situations. One is you have a detainee, you go before a court, and there's no real evidence that this person was a dangerous fighter. He says, I was a cab driver, I was a goat herder, and I was picked up. That person, I think, will be able to argue, I should be released and released now. But what if there's a lot of evidence that says this guy had an AK-47, he was a fighter, he's a dangerous person? What does the judge do? The court didn't actually answer that question. If you're a civilian and I say, Neil, you're a dangerous guy, you can say, oh, sure, that may be so, but you've got to charge me with a crime.
And prove it in court.
Prove it in court. If you're a soldier, we could say, okay, you're a soldier. We're not going to let you go back and fight against us. We're going to hold
you. Until the war's over.
Until the war's over. So they didn't actually decide the substantive question of what is the law in the end when these cases go back before federal judges.
I just wonder, in terms of the Supreme Court, is this going to be the Bush administration's last bite at this particular set of issues? By the time the cases come back before the court, he's not likely to be president anymore.
Yes, that's absolutely right. This is going to be the Obama-McCain administration to really handle this. This issue will definitely kick over. They may move Guantanamo, but somewhere along the line, this will be decided in the years ahead, not before President Bush leaves office.
Stay with us, if you would, David. Joining us now is Geetanjali Gutierrez. She's a staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights and part of the legal team that argued on behalf of the detainees' rights before the Supreme Court in this case. And I guess the first things we have to say is congratulations.
Thank you, Neil.
Are you pleased with this decision?
We're extremely pleased, yes.
And how far does this go in terms of David's case? If you can go to a federal court now on behalf of one of your clients and say he's being held unconstitutionally, can you do that? Where can you do that? How soon can you do that?
We can do that in the federal courts in the District of Columbia. We can do that immediately. And this has been a tremendous victory. We've finally gotten the rule of law restored and in many ways depoliticized this whole detention situation in Guantanamo and gotten each of the individuals and the government's assertions now into a federal court before a district judge in a regular habeas proceeding, and it's a tremendous victory.
Is it clear to you, though, if a court says your client is being held unconstitutionally, that he would be then released?
I think that the Supreme Court was very careful in how they crafted the decision, and really the idea of practicality is just a theme throughout the whole opinion. And so when it comes to the question of remedy, the court made clear that is the same as in any other historical case of habeas. If the court finds that our client or an individual is being held unlawfully in Guantanamo, it has the ability and flexibility under habeas to craft an appropriate remedy. So it really, in many instances for these individuals, they are going to be found to have been held unlawfully. The government just simply doesn't have a legal basis for detaining them. They don't have facts to prove that they were fighting because these men weren't fighting. And people like that most likely will be ordered to be released if the government doesn't just release them on its own. I think for individuals who have committed a crime, whether it's a violation of the laws of war or a criminal act, the court will likely give the government an option to charge them rather than release them.
And let me ask you, in particular, you have, I think, a couple of clients in Guantanamo Bay. Can you tell us a little bit about them and how you think this ruling affects their particular cases?
Sure. The center represents a number of men, and certainly we are working with hundreds of attorneys that are representing the prisoners at Guantanamo. One situation that we have, or one of the situations of our clients, involves a man who is from Libya who cannot be returned to Libya because he was, the United States alleges he was part of a political opposition group to Gaddafi, who, of course, is a very anti-democratic dictator. So if our client is sent back to Libya, he faces certain persecution and will be imprisoned and may face torture. So he's someone who the United States has been trying to send back to Libya and has been refusing to let him be reunited with his family in another country. There are approximately 50 or so prisoners in that similar position. We're hoping now that a habeas court is involved and will have a judge supervising his case that will be able to negotiate with the United States to have him in particular reunited with his family in a safe third country. For other clients, we believe that they're being held based on information that's been extracted through torture, either of themselves or because of other detainees' torture. And those are the kinds of cases that we'd want to get before a judge and be able to say that the government's only evidence against our client is information that's come from torture and shouldn't
and
be considered.
Therefore inadmissible. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right, let's see if we can get a caller in on the conversation. By the way, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Our guests, Geetanjali Gutierrez and David Savage of the Los Angeles Times. Tino's on the line. Tino calling us from Cincinnati.
Hi there.
Hi.
This is Thank you for taking my call. This is a pretty simple question, and forgive me if I'm naive, but I'm wondering why the government is so afraid of bringing these detainees between in front of the court and being able to say why we have them. I mean, I understand we have to protect our law enforcement and military agencies and the people we have undercover or whatever that are trying to do and trying to protect the American people. But what's the problem? Why can't we tell people why we have them if we're supposed to be leading the world in the fight on terrorism?
Yeah, David Savage, what was the government's argument for saying they do not have the right of habeas corpus?
Well, I think there was two questions there, like sort of why don't they do it openly? I don't know the answer to the question of why they didn't allow more openness. In other words, the substantive answer is that the government believes, the military believes, is these were dangerous people. We picked them up on the battlefield in Afghanistan or something like that. We think they were dangerous fighters. They were committed Islamic something or other, militants. And if we let them go, they're going to go back to Afghanistan or to Iraq and fight against us. That's what they say. I don't know the answer to the question of why they wouldn't allow that to be said to some degree in a public hearing. That's what we're going to get as a public hearing. But I think they do think they know why they want to keep them. I don't understand why they wouldn't allow some of that evidence to be presented so the public could understand it better.
Jeetan Dali Gutierrez, in 30 seconds, can you take a speculate as to why the opposition in your case would have felt that way?
I think there's a lot of opposition because of how the evidence was extracted or obtained and not wanting to sort of bring that kind of government misconduct into open court. And I think in many ways this has never been about the individual detainees. This has been about the power of the president. And the administration has wanted to assert that the president was above the law, and the Supreme Court made very clear today that that's not true.
Thanks very much for the call, Tina.
Thank you very much.
We're talking with David Savage of the Los Angeles Times and Jeetan Dali Gutierrez of the Center for Constitutional Rights about the Supreme Court's decision today that ruled in favor of detainees at Guantanamo Bay, saying they do have the right of habeas corpus. They can go to federal court and say, let me go unless you charge me. I'm Neil Conan. We'll also be hearing from the other side a little bit later in the program. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The Supreme Court ruled today that foreign terror suspects being held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, have rights under the Constitution to challenge their detention in civilian court. We're talking about what that ruling says and what it doesn't. Our guests are David Savage, who covers the court for the Los Angeles Times, as well as Jeetan Dali Gutierrez, staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights and the first habeas attorney to meet with clients at Guantanamo. If you'd have a question for them about the ruling, what it means for detainees at Guantanamo and elsewhere, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And Jeetan Dali Gutierrez, does this decision affect the military commissions that are underway, the so-called tribunals of the trials of some of the detainees alleged to have committed war crimes? They are already underway.
Well, there's about 15 of those detainees out of the 270 prisoners that are facing commissions. And although the opinion doesn't deal directly with the legal questions in those cases, the court's findings about Guantanamo and their rulings that Guantanamo actually falls within the scope of the court's jurisdiction, those may have implications for the commissions, and it certainly means that as those prisoners go through their trials, that they would have some relief in habeas, some form, once the trials are over in federal court.
Let's go to Steve. Steve calling us from St. Louis in Missouri.
Hi, my question is about what this case does for the Congress's ability to strip courts of jurisdiction, because my understanding is that Congress had tried twice to say lower courts and appellate courts can't hear these cases, and while the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction, it's unlikely that they would take up hundreds of habeas cases. So given that this seems like such a, you know, this is kind of the third time around, is it ever possible for Congress to say, you know, there are these class of cases that courts can't hear, or will the court always say where there's some fundamental right like this with, you know, the right to challenge your detention that, you know, it's so important that lower courts must hear it and Congress can't get in the way?
David, what do you think? What does the ruling say?
Well, I think his big question is unanswered. That is, we never confronted the situation where Congress has stripped away the power of the courts to hear a whole category of cases, and it's been upheld. it does seem like the Supreme Court's inclined to say this is in the Constitution. Congress can only take it away during a time of insurrection. They didn't do that here. And they basically rejected Congress's move to get them out of this business. And I thought that was going to be a really hard issue for them, and I think that's why they spent 60 pages writing this opinion, because they had to conclude that the habeas corpus was so fundamental, so much a part of the principle, it was in the Constitution at the time, and in effect Congress can't limit it, can't take it away.
Jitanjali Gutierrez, is that your interpretation?
It is. I think the court recognized that habeas is a historical tool that people use to keep from being imprisoned unlawfully, whether it's the king or the president. And they did spend a great deal of time going back to the British Empire and historical cases where habeas was recognized. And so I think the decision earlier, the first time the Supreme Court considered the detentions, it was a case considering a statute, a habeas statute. But this is a constitutional decision that gives us much more finality, and it was a rebuke to the Congress for trying to take away that right.
Steve, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And Jitanjali Gutierrez, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
Jitanjali Gutierrez, a staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights and part of the legal team that argued on behalf of detainee rights before the Supreme Court in this case. And let's see if we can go to another guest now. Joining us with a different view is David Rifkin, a legal and policy advisor for the first President Bush and during the Reagan administration as well. He's currently a partner with the law firm Baker & Hostetler here in Washington, D.C. And thanks for being back with us on this issue.
Good to be with you, Neil.
And are you disappointed with the ruling today?
Disappointed and saddened. It is one of the worst, not to be dramatic, one of the four or five worst Supreme Court decisions. It's breathtaking for its arrogance because this is actually not about detainee rights. The basic proposition here is that the court believes henceforth, without any historical basis or any basis in prior case law, which they disingenuously, by the way, misconstrue to avoid acknowledging how much of a many cases they're overturning, they're basically saying the Constitution follows the flag. It's not about Guantanamo. It's about anywhere in the world. And by the way, with all due respect to my good friend, Mr. Savage, it's not just about, they do say there's fundamental importance of the of habeas corpus, but equal protection clause, due process clause, right to confrontation are equally fundamental and foundational. They basically said the following: to heck with you of two political branches, and by the way, they said it very candidly, we want a seat at the table, and we're going to have first and last say in this. And by the way, our view is fundamentally that no issue anymore in national security sphere can be resolved without us playing a role, and without, and they said it very clearly, without the Constitution applying, we exist at your sufferance, political branches. You can give us something statutorily, you give it, but you also take it.
But isn't it their role to say, Mr. President, you on the behalf of the executive branch have overstepped, you in Congress, you've overstepped, this is not constitutional?
Of course, it's their role to say if there's a constitutional basis for it, but the notion that every exertion of political power by the United States as a government, as a body polity, is necessarily subject to judicial review, especially when it's done overseas and impacts non-Americans, would have stunned every single framer. I mean, that's breathtakingly arrogant. The Constitution doesn't say the judiciary has to be stirring every pot.
What do you think the practical effect of this ruling is going to be?
The practical effect is, first of all, it engenders enormous uncertainty. It basically says the Constitution applies to what you do overseas, certainly in the case of habeas, but potentially in the case of many other constitutional provisions. But we're not going to tell you exactly what it means. So you go back and come back to us. You pass another statute and another statute and another statute, and we'll tell you again. We'll be basically the school marm here. But that's sort of a big picture. The small picture, and away from constitutional, you know, highfalutin stuff to practical implications, they made it very clear in their discussion why what Congress created here, and by the way, your caller was wrong. Congress did not divest everybody below a Supreme Court level of jurisdiction. They put the jurisdiction for review in the D.C. Circuit, okay, instead of starting with a district court, which, by the way, Congress could abolish. Congress could abolish all district courts tomorrow. There's no constitutional entitlement to having district courts. Congress can abolish all court of appeals, the only court that has to remain inviolate, Supreme Court. But basically, what they said in their discussion of why the particular judicial review mode that Congress created here is insufficient, they made very clear majority opinion written by Justice Kennedy, but they want presence of lawyers, but they want the presence of individuals believed to be enemy combatants during the entire portion of proceedings. Now, we're not talking about military commissions here. We're talking about basically a process to confirm that you're indeed an enemy combatant. And by the way, Neil, it's not limited to unlawful enemy combatants. It's limited to lawful ones, too. So henceforth, in every war in which the United States is engaged in a fight, whenever they capture somebody and take this person, you know, 10, 15 miles away from a battlefield to some secure location, that person will be entitled to a Miranda, to a lawyer, to Miranda warning, to a lawyer, and an opportunity to have access to some district court.
Even if that person is wearing the uniform of the opposing army and carrying a weapon?
But, Neil, he can say, I'm sorry, I'm an innocent shepherd. I came upon this uniform, and, you know, I was wearing rags. I just put it on.
It's not an argument that's likely to hold much water, is it?
No, but forgive me. That's a question of process. That's a question of a system. Lots of arguments made by criminal suspects and enemy combatants don't hold any water. My point is this. On the face of his decision, anybody who claims that he is not an enemy combatant, no matter how compelling of evidence may seem to be against that person, is entitled to essentially a criminal level of justice level of due process, which is enormously, enormously practically difficult. And let's be honest here. A bunch of people we have in custody today under that system would have to be released, not because they're innocent shepherds, but just because there's not enough evidence to withstand that level of rigorous due process, which is why, by the way, they're not before military commissions. So we're going to have to let some of the very bad guys go. And I hate to sound dramatic, the consequences for all the horrible things that people are going to accomplish is not going to be on the shoulders of the political branches. It's going to be on the shoulders of a court's majority.
And so in that sense, you don't think that Justice Scalia's comment that this would almost certainly cause the more Americans to be killed, you don't think that's over the top?
I think it's very much under the top. No, I mean, it's interesting. The thing that frankly bothers me more than anything is just the sheer technically sort of insipid character of a decision. Be honest. Acknowledge that you overturn Eisentrager. Acknowledge that you overturn a whole bunch of cases instead of being weaselly and pretending that you didn't distinguish them. And the last couple of paragraphs that talk about, well, it's now back to the political branches. No, Mr. Justice Kennedy, it's not back to the political branches. You made it impossible for political branches to come up with any workable system. And by the way, while you're at it, you didn't even give the political branches any guidance as to how to deal with those issues, because, again, it is not, repeat, not about habeas only. There's nothing in the constitutional text which says habeas is sacred, but equal protection clause isn't. So how is the U.S. government supposed to know, when it wages combat operations, which involve many things other than detaining captured combatants, how is it to know, in what way is it appropriate for it to comply with the full panoply of relevant constitutional provisions? I don't know. I don't think anybody in the administration knows. So we don't have to come back to – I mean, this whole thing, as I said, is breathtaking in its enormous grab of power, well beyond Guantanamo, well beyond detention issues.
David Rifkin, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Pleasure.
David Rifkin, who served in several legal and policy positions in the administrations of Ronald Reagan and the first President Bush, and currently a partner at Baker and Hostetler here in Washington, D.C. David Savage, as I'm going through that, is this an overreach by the Supreme Court, as we just heard by David Rifkin argue, or was this a correction of overreaching by the President and the Congress, as we heard earlier?
Well, that's a hard one. Depends whether you like the majority or the dissent. I think that there has been a majority in the court all along to say that if you're going to hold these people for a long time, you have to give them some judicial review. Kennedy acknowledged in his opinion, by the way, that this doesn't apply to – we would have a different view in an emergency, and we'd have a different view if this was a short-term thing. In other words, if there were another 9/11, we're not saying these people – everybody you pick up has to have an immediate habeas corpus. They said this is a different thing than an emergency. We're 6 years down the road. If the government is going to insist that we can hold people indefinitely, United States control, then you've got to have give them some sort of give a judge the power to review the detention to see if it's legal. So in that sense, it's not that big a holding just to say these people can go in the front door of the courthouse. I agree with David Rifkin to the extent that there is a lot of uncertainty, though, once they get in the front door and how this is going to play out. There's a good chance the Bush administration or the next administration will say, we're going to close Guantanamo and we're going to move all these people to Charleston or to Leavenworth. hold them in the United States, and give them hearings. And there's going to be a lot of litigation. Some of the men will be released, I think, and some, I think it's possible, some will continue to be held. But it's going to be a continued long, heavy on litigation, a long process ahead.
Would this whole thing have been moot, unimportant, not argued, if the Bush administration had said, these are prisoners of war in the first place, Geneva Convention applies?
I think so. I think had they said from the beginning, we're going to treat them like prisoners of war, we're going to give them the brief, what was supposed to be battlefield hearings, and then we're going to hold them. Basically, they would have been acting under a recognized military law, international law, and I think there's a good chance we would not have been through 6 years of litigation on this.
David Savage of the Los Angeles Times, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get a caller on the line. This is Jim. Jim with us in Sioux City, Iowa.
Yes, thank you very much, Neil, and thank you to the guests. The individual who just made reference to having some judicial review of those being held and having that review sometime before the 6 years are up, I think that's clear. I believe that, too.
Mm-hmm.
I did not like, nor did I believe it's true, that this was, as one of your prior guests said, that this was a way to show that the president is not above the law. Here's what I'm referring to. You know, I would like to, she apparently said that as sort of a political statement. Well, you know what? If we have somebody that's setting up another type of 9/11, and we don't want to start to tell the United States citizenry about all of this because, after all, it's a little bit of something that has to be sort of on the quiet for the time being. Well, then you go ahead and, yeah, there are dangerous people out there, and I don't think I don't think we need to have our hands tied or our president's hands tied in order to have our needs met. So I like the position, is what I'm trying to say, that POWs, Geneva Convention, this is not a war. I wish I could call it what I would like to call it is terrorism. And it is. It's terrorism. It's not war. And how, by the way, since we can do such a good job of trying to take our look at our own problems and in the world, what are we doing that's above the, you know, rule of law and so on and so forth? Yes, but, you know, what influence do we have on these other places where they put three men on a bridge and shoot them? I'll play on a level playing field, but just tell me what the field's about.
I'm trying to devise a question from what you've been saying, and what I'm getting is, David Savage, does the Constitution draw a distinction between, there's certainly procedures for declarations of war, which were not followed in this particular case, haven't been followed since the Second World War, but nevertheless, everybody pretty well accepts that war is a concept that does not necessarily require a declaration. Nevertheless, is there a distinction in any way between war and terrorism?
Well, yes, and it's I think unfortunate in the period of 2002 that the 2003 that the Bush administration didn't go back to Congress and try to get a legal authority to hold people in this war on terrorism and say something like, these people are allied with terrorist groups, they're dangerous people, they're not standard prisoners of war, and they're not standard criminals, but we want to give them some reasonable hearings to determine who they are, but then have the legal authority to hold them indefinitely because they're bad people and we don't want to set them loose to go back and cause problems. And it's unfortunate that the administration didn't do that. They thought if we set up this prison outside the sovereign territory of the United States, that no federal courts and and we could run this as a military matter. And that's the way they operated from 2000. That was the model. Their whole thing was to keep federal judges out of this. And so we spent all these years litigating whether the detainees could go into court and challenge their detention. The answer is now, yes, they can, but we don't really have a lot of law as to what it is, you know, whether the government can indefinitely hold people it says are dangerous.
And obviously, much remains to be decided.
Yes, and that
cases
remains
down
to
the
be
road.
Decided.
And we hope you'll be back with us when those decisions come down. David Savage of the Los Angeles Times. Coming up, no matter how hard they train in the weight room, sometimes professional athletes hit a wall. On the other side of that wall is the world of illegal steroids. A new documentary called Bigger, Stronger, Faster details how that world of sports got that way. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation. Stay with us from NPR News.